The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, welcome back. It's the end of the week, Friday, wherever you are, somewhere around this planet. It's already Saturday, so some of you know Saturday will get here. Our guest this first hour tonight is a gentleman, just a remarkable man. It's been a number of years since he's been on. Very honored to have him back. Dr. Edwin Vieira. He's a PhD, JD, been to Harvard, all that. For more than 30 years, Edwin Vieira has practiced law with an emphasis on constitutional issues. He is also one of our country's most eminent constitutional attorneys, having brought four cases that were accepted by the Supreme Court to be heard and having won three of them. It's quite a remarkable accomplishment. He is a great patriot, a brilliant man. We could spend probably 5 or 6 hours if he had the time, but we're going to talk about the Second Amendment, about the militia issue, about where we should go with this, and what's happening. Hello, Edwin. Thank you very much for being here. It's great to have you back on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. I didn't realize who you were talking about.
Oh, that's good. Well, I will assume there aren't clones of you yet, but
okay.
With these people running the show, you never know. All right. Now, patriot, Americans, Constitution. These things seem to be in disfavor with the global elite, all of those terms and everything connected to them. How much of our Constitution, let me just do this in general terms real quick, how much of our Constitution is still there and still applicable in a real world circumstance, given that the courts are by and large corrupted now in too many cases? Where are we? How much of a Constitution do we have left?
I think you have very little, although you have some interesting glimmers, because you had some recent Supreme Court opinions that have, number one, begun to undermine the administrative state process, and number two, have been carrying on, at least in the correct direction, with respect to the Second Amendment. Of course, we did have the terrible decision dealing with the 2020 election question, where the Supreme Court refused to hear that case brought by Texas versus Pennsylvania, which, I mean, that always struck me as one of the it will go down in history as one of the great betrayals of the Supreme
Court. It's not a failure, it's a betrayal. You're right.
Oh, I think totally. So. Because the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court was designed precisely for that kind of a problem. One state versus another state, or one state versus the United States, where the Supreme Court was going to be the arbiter among the states, or with the states in respect to the government of the United States. And in this particular case, although I don't want to get into too deep with this because we're going to talk about another subject, that whole question of the Electoral College is a question in which the states have the primary judicial standing, because the Electoral College is really the representative sent from the several states to determine who the President of the United States should be. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that the Constitution of the United States does not necessarily provide for a plebiscite for electing the President in any state. It gives to the state legislatures the determination of how the electors are to be chosen. So that Electoral College is really an institution of the states, and therefore Texas and the states on Texas' side clearly had standing to raise the question of whether the electoral votes coming out of Pennsylvania and Georgia, whatever other states were involved on the other side, were questionable. Let's not even say legitimate or fraudulent, simply were questionable. And that was an issue, it seems to me, specifically provided for in the structure of the Constitution.
Well, Edwin, if I might say one thing, as a neophyte, but I've been around this news business for long enough to know, if there was ever a case designed for the Supreme Court's purpose of being, that was it.
That's right. So the fact that they looked the other way, bounced it out on what I would call a fictional argument on their side, struck me as something that was terrifically out of bounds for anyone who has any consideration just of the constitutional structure. I don't care where you would come out on the merits of that case, but the fact that they wouldn't take it was the problem.
I would inject the word suspicious in there somewhere. It was just too weird.
I know. Considering some of the cases that they have taken, trivial issues in the past, and they let this one bounce. And the difficulty is now it sets a precedent for the future.
Correct. That's the part of it. Agreed.
Right. The judicial system knows now that it can walk away from this kind of situation and get away with that kind of abdication of responsibility.
How the hell can we hold them accountable? How could we do that?
Well, there's your problem. You see, when the electoral process breaks down, it's extraordinarily difficult to imagine, unless you go and pick a direction I'm going to discuss, how you can hold the system accountable. Because you look at the political party structure now. As far as I'm concerned, a lot of other people, the great existential threat that's posed to this country is our political party structure. Madison told us about this, the Federalist Number 10, the danger of factionalism, especially when the faction becomes a majority faction, that's a majority of the population on its side, which if you take the Democratic Party and a large segment of the Republican Party, there's your faction right there, the majority faction. Washington warned us about this in his farewell address. The whole question of political parties being fundamentally antithetical to the concept of Republican government because they don't represent the public interest. They represent some party interest, which may be antithetical to the interest of Republican government, usually is in the long run. So there we have a problem, the party structure. Yeah. If the courts won't control it, obviously the legislature won't control it and the executive branch won't control it because the legislature and the executive branch at every level in our government, states all the way to the government of the United States, are in the control of the party structure. So you have this vicious political circle that's built up.
I get it. Yeah.
If you come back to the Constitution and you say, well, and the Declaration of Independence, when you come to one of these partings of the ways, who is supposed to control this system? Well, a Republican form of government is designed to represent the wishes of the people, or as the Declaration of Independence said, the good people. And it makes it very interesting. It makes that clear distinction explicitly between the good people and then implicitly the others, the bad people. Because the Declaration of Independence was speaking for whom? The patriots, the people who were for separation from the British Empire. And there were many so-called Tories, so-called loyalists, loyal to the king, within the colonies, who wanted to remain a part of the British Empire. Those were, from the patriots' point of view, the bad people. They were the ones who couldn't see the violation of the rights of Englishmen, which had been perpetrated by the king and his ministers. That long list, that indictment in the Declaration of Independence of all of these various things that proved that King George III was basically a tyrant. George and his ministers, of course. So when they built the Constitution on the principle of the Declaration of Independence, they put into it, both at the level of the government of the United States and the level of the state governments, and the independent state governments. And you find this in the Articles of Confederation as well. This structure called the militia. And now I'm not talking about people running around in the woods with camouflage outfits, these guys that call themselves militia, and you know they're out engaged in kind of paramilitary training or whatever. That has nothing to do with it.
Right, this is important, everyone, so listen carefully. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I mean, there are those people, and they have motivations that range from, in a sense, good intentions all the way to the other extreme. But I'm not talking about them. Because they have set themselves outside of this whole discussion that we're having. They are not part of this discussion. I'm talking about the constitutional militia. And where do you find this? Well, you find in the United States Constitution, most people look at the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, if you look at that, you would say, well, what's the purpose? What is that Second Amendment aiming at? Well, it's the free state. And the thing that's necessary to the security of the free state, the maintenance of the free state, is this thing called a well-regulated militia. And that's why the people have the right to keep and bear arms, because if you look into American history in the colonial period and the period of the independent states before the Constitution was finally ratified, all of the colonies and the independent states had a colonial or a state militia, except for a period of time when Pennsylvania didn't, because Pennsylvania was ruled by the Quakers and they were pacifists. Mm-hmm. And even Pennsylvania came around to it in 1776, so by the time you get to the independent states in the War of Independence, they all had a militia. And these militias were statutory creations, or at the beginning, they were actually the creations of the original colonial charters that the king gave. And they were supposed to be, and were in fact, populated or made up of all of the able-bodied citizenry that was believed capable of military service. So typically it was from 15 or 16 years of age, because people matured earlier in those days, up to 50, 55, 60 years of age, because at that point people became superannuated. Right? They couldn't see, they had arthritis, they had heart conditions, there were all sorts of incurable ailments, so they couldn't perform that function. But otherwise, every able-bodied male citizen, because women were in a different legal and social cultural situation, were by law required to be members of the militia of their particular colony or state. Mm-hmm. And they were required by law to be armed, to be trained, to come out on a regular basis, and if necessary, to be called forth, that's a typical language, to be called forth to, and the three basic purposes were the ones we find in the U.S. Constitution, execute the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And probably if you look to the various laws of the states today, you will find that same basic structure. Virginia, where I live, militia of the Commonwealth of Virginia, is composed of every able-bodied citizen, male and female now, from 16 to 55 years of age, who is a resident of Virginia citizen or an alien who has taken the necessary steps to begin to get his citizenship. And they're broken down into three parts, what they call the National Guard, which really isn't a militia. We won't get into that. It's too complicated. A thing called the Virginia Defense Force, which is a little organization of about 700 people. Uh-huh. And then everybody else in the so-called unorganized militia. That's about 4,500,000 people from the last time I did a demographic study.
Theoretically, Edwin, who would control that group? That's a goodly size.
It's not theoretical. Statutorily, it's the governor.
It is the
commander-in-chief by the Virginia Constitution. That's probably true throughout all of the 50 states. And that's at the state level. So you have a state militia, and this goes all the way back to the 1600s, from the beginning of the colonies. And the U.S. Constitution refers to those structures as the militia of the several states, because there's one in each state. And it gives to Congress the authority to provide for calling forth those militia to do what? Execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. The states have the power to execute the laws of the various states, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, or in Virginia and other places, they also allowed to deal with natural disasters or, you know, man-made industrial accidents, whatever, the aftermaths of those.
Could the states, Edwin, excuse me, could the states repel an invasion spawned, perpetrated by the illegal federal government?
Oh, sake, yes, if people go to newswithviews.com and look up my archive, one of the last two or three articles that I wrote dealt precisely with that problem. That actually is found in Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 of the Constitution, which says that no state without the consent of Congress shall engage in war unless, and the unless is a very interesting part, all right? That provision is a limitation, basically it's a limitation on the state power, except no state shall, without the consent of Congress, engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. Huh. Well, is there an actual invasion of those states that have a border with Mexico going on right now?
You got it.
Well, what's going on right now is a parallel of what went on in the Roman Empire. What happened to the Roman Empire? It was called the barbarian invasions, right?
Overran.
I mean, everybody knows that history. Everybody went to high school, knows that kind of history, right? And not only do you have invasion in the sense of just huge masses of people crossing the border for the purpose of settling within the United States, but you have the cartel involvement there. Mm-hmm. These paramilitary groups, which probably have some kind of governmental support, certainly from the Chinese, because the Chinese are sending the ingredients to make fentanyl, which the cartels then ship across the border into the United States to kill, 100,000 people so far in the United States, they estimate, been killed by this drug. Mm-hmm. Cartels are involved in that. And it may very well be that there are foreign governments besides the Chinese that are involved in that, because somebody is paying for this huge influx of people to cross Mexico and to come to the United States.
Oh, it's being bankrolled at a very high level.
We look at this, and there are all sorts of implications here. But one point is that the Constitution reserves explicitly the power for the states to engage in war. Well, let's say you're talking about engaging in war against the cartels. Right? Those are illegal enemy combatants, aren't they? Didn't we hear about that in the Patriot Act?
Got that, right.
Right, totally they're illegal enemy combatants. Well, why aren't they being dealt with? Well, for one reason, is the present administration in Washington seems to be sitting on its hands. Let's leave them aside for the moment. What about the states? Texas, there's a good one. Forget California, but Texas. Texas has the constitutional power to engage in war, and you tell me what that would be, what kind of steps you could take that would be called engaging in war, for dealing with an actual invasion. Now, Texas would have to call on some kind of organized force to deal with that. They have the National Guard. The problem with the National Guard is you might have kind of an intervention by the people in Washington, D.C. who would say, well, wait a minute, the president's going to take over the National Guard. We're not going to let you do that. Right? You're going to be somehow preempted by federal law and use of
so the
National Guard.
So the governor, can the governor or can the governor not call up a constitutional militia? Forget the Guard.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Train
that's
them?
Point number two. Yeah. I would bet, I haven't looked at it, but I would bet that the Texas statutory code looks similar to Virginia in the sense that the vast mass of Texans who are not in the National Guard, and they're a small number, and if Texas has a state defense force, that's an even smaller number. So we're talking about several million people in Texas.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes.
Are probably members of something that's called the unorganized militia or the reserve militia. Those are the two terms that you typically see. And you would probably find in Texas the same situation that we have in Virginia. The governor is commander-in-chief of the militia, and he has the power to call forth the militia to do what? To execute the laws of Virginia, to suppress insurrections in Virginia, and to repel invasions of Virginia. Just substitute the word Texas for Virginia. It's the same situation.
See, if we were really a constitutional republic, probably this very thing would be going on out of necessity because we have a fraud in the White House and a fake government in D.C. It's not representative of us at all.
This wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't have had this problem because
if
those
had
states, forget California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, at some point their governors would have said, we have the power to call up
And they do.
That's right. This is not a fantasy. This is not someone suggesting what the policy should be or that we need an amendment to the Constitution. If those statutory codes are similar at all to Virginia, they probably are because they all follow the same pattern. And it's interesting that they would have the authority to call up a very large number of people perform that militia function of repelling invasions. And it's interesting that Abbott, Greg Abbott, that's his name, isn't it? Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, not too long ago came out and recognized that what he was facing there was an actual invasion. He used that term. Now, I find it very interesting, and these people are so out of touch with reality, that number one, he didn't look at Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 of the Constitution and say, wait a minute, I have this reserved state power to engage in war to suppress this invasion. And where would that take me? And then the next question is, well, how would I do that? Oh, look at this. I have this power as the commander-in-chief of the Texas Reserve Militia, or unorganized militia, whatever the term is that they use in their code, to call forth probably a couple million people to perform the function of what? Repelling invasions. So we have from two directions. And the Second Amendment, of course, what if it's interesting, the Second Amendment? Second Amendment talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms for what purpose?
To participate in the militias.
Yeah, that's right, to perform functions within the militia for the security of a free state. Well, you can't have the security of a free state if you don't have secure borders, if you can't protect your state against invasion. One would think that's the key to maintaining the security of a free state, security of any kind of state, is to protect your borders against invasion. So you put all three of those things together, and you say, why aren't they taking the appropriate action, at least Texas? I don't know about Arizona, New Mexico, certainly California, but why is it Texas doing that? Or some other states. There was someone on the other day, Jeff, from I think he was a former Border Patrol officer or somebody who had that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, this isn't simply a problem of Texas. I think he was in Texas at the time. This isn't simply a problem of Texas because these people are coming out and going from Texas throughout the country. And certainly the illegal drugs are going throughout the country.
Oh my God,
and the cartels that are putting these women and children into sexual slavery are working throughout the country. So the invasion is throughout all of the states.
As you know, Edwin, they are being flown and bused all over the U.S. to designated areas and installed as if they were living tumors in the body of American political history. They are horrible. This is an invasion. No other way to look at it. And you just heard the explanation as to how it could be dealt with without having to go through the federal government at all if Greg Abbott had a spine and understood the Constitution. I wish Edwin could sit down with him for a half an hour and straighten him out. They can do this. They can stop it. They can finish that wall right now. And they can grab everyone they can and force them to walk south. Gone. Go ahead.
Yeah, see, the thing, what's interesting in Virginia, because I often talk to people here, I'm being facetious when I talk to them, many lawyers that I run into, and I ask this question. I said, do you belong to a militia? And they'll look at me sideways. Oh, no, I don't know. Guy's crazy. Guy's running around the woods with guns. No, I don't have anything. I said, no, wait a minute. Are you between 16 and 55 years of age? Are you able-bodied? Yes, I am. Then you belong to the militia of Virginia, and the governor has the power to call you forth to repel an invasion where your life might be put on the line. Right? You might be killed. You might be maimed. You might be driven insane with post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, repelling an invasion. And if you don't show up according to the laws of Virginia, you can be court-martialed. Right now, that's the law.
Uh-huh.
And you know what the penalty is for desertion in the face of the enemy?
Capital.
Typically?
Capital?
The highest penalty that can be imposed for that?
Capital punishment?
Yeah, death. You're talking about the Uniform Code of Military Justice, all right? You're not talking about some civil code. So in Virginia, everyone from 16 to 55, and actually above 55, because the governor has other authority to draft anyone he wants to, but certainly from 16 to 55, could be called up tomorrow morning to go and repel an invasion of Virginia, and if they didn't show up, they could be arrested and court-martialed. And I would bet that in most of the other states, there are some state statutory provisions that are similar to that, and that the governors have something of that level of authority. And what's happening? Well, they're not using it. They're sitting back, I don't know, waiting for the Border Patrol to handle it, which it can't because it's his hands are tied, apparently, waiting for somebody to call out the National Guard from Washington, D.C., which is very unlikely that it's going to happen, certainly with the group of people we have in control in Washington, D.C. now. And apparently, these governors either are looking the other way, or they don't know what direction to look at to figure out what their own powers are. And that's what I find amazing, because politically speaking, if someone like Abbott came forward and said publicly, here's what I could do. I could call out 2 million Texans tomorrow and send them down to the border. I think action would be coming from Washington, D.C. within an hour of his statement. Because I don't think Washington, D.C. wants to have the states taking this kind of action, realizing what their authority is.
No, they would throw, because they would throw the federales out of the state of Texas.
Yeah, so
as invaders and operating under false premises. Go ahead.
So, but that's only one aspect of this problem.
Yeah.
If you look at the execution of the laws authority of the militia, it's at two levels. Execute the laws of the states, and then execute the laws of the union when called forth by Congress. And I love to give the example here of the, you know, this problem we're having with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the level of apparent, I don't know what, insouciance. Let's not call it corruption, because we don't have these people under, you know, testifying as to why they're doing what they're doing. But what's been coming out now about the incompetence or whatever of the Federal Bureau of Investigation? Well, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is not a constitutional entity. Right? It has this history that was developed over many, many years, kind of like Topsy just grew. Right? J. Edgar Hoover made it into what it was, or what
it
is.
His own personal
fiefdom,
guard.
Right?
Yeah.
What is the constitutional entity, constitutional establishment, that has the power to execute the laws of the Union? If you read the Constitution, it's the militia of the several states under the authority of the President of the United States, who is given the particular duty to take care of the laws be faithfully executed. So you have the President, he has the duty to take care of the laws be faithfully executed. That's Article 2, Section 3. Article 2, Section 1, he's made the Commander-in-Chief of the militia when called into the actual service of the United States, and they can be called into the actual service of the United States, one purpose being to execute the laws of the Union. So if you wanted to run a constitutional Federal Bureau of Investigation type operation, how would you set it up according to the Constitution? Well, it would be made up of people drawn from the militia of the various states, and they would always remember, because of their origins, that they were there on behalf of their own states. This is the federal structure, all right? On behalf of their own states, you wouldn't have this specialized bureaucratic fiefdom that apparently sees itself as totally independent, not only of the people of the United States, but even independent of the President of the United States.
That's true.
Which I find incredible, because he's the one that has the power to take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
Exactly.
That's interesting. If you look at it from the point of view of that particular power of the president, theoretically, the president could take care of the laws be executed in all manner of speaking. He could be the investigator. He could be the prosecutor. Right? He could be the caretaker of the prisons. He could perform all of those executive functions in order to take care of the laws were faithfully executed. Now, obviously, he can't do that simply because one man can't do that. So Congress over the years has created these various agencies to aid the president in performing that constitutional function. But the only institutions that are actually named in the Constitution to do that are the militia of the several states. And they are the only institutions that play no role in that today. You see how far we've gotten away from the Constitution?
Oh, so far. That's why I asked the question in the beginning of the program. Yes. We need binoculars to see it in some cases.
Yeah. And yet it's obvious when you read the document. Let's give another example. You remember back to the Bundy Ranch business.
Sure.
And there was a conflict with the Department of the Interior, which claims authority to regulate certain lands. We won't get into whether the federal government has control over those lands, but that's what they do. All right. Now, let's assume just for one moment that the Department of the Interior was a legitimate constitutional entity, that it was doing things that were actually constitutional, that there were, in fact, some lands in Nevada, I think it was, that they had regulatory power over. Question would be, well, how do you want that regulatory power exercised in Nevada? Well, wouldn't that be better to have it exercised by people in Nevada who knew what the lay of the land was, who knew what the local people wanted and so forth and so on, instead of some nameless, faithless bureaucrats coming out of Washington, D.C.? All right, execute the laws of the union. We've got some laws with respect to federal lands. Who do we have execute it? Well, the local militia from Nevada, the local militia from Oregon, whoever they might be, whichever state we're talking about. Because those local individuals would have a much better understanding of what the local situation was. And this is called federalism. Some people have heard of that concept.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Uh-huh. And there it is, built into the system. Now, that isn't what we have. Every one of these agencies has its own police mechanism by which it comes down into the various states with its own armed agents and investigators and so forth and so on, instead of doing what the Constitution lays out as clearly the path to follow, which is for Congress in each one of these situations, which is, well, I'm assuming just for purposes of argument, is legitimate, right, is to have a militia structure deal with this. The local militia, the state militia structure, would deal with the enforcement, the execution, as the Constitution says, the execution of those laws of the union within the various states, because that would be the essence of maintaining the federal system. And we would assume that those state militias, aware of the 10th Amendment and aware of the 9th Amendment, would not go beyond the limits of the constitutional parameters with respect to whatever laws were coming out of Washington that the people in Washington wanted those local militias to enforce within their own states. We'd have a check and balance. Some people have heard of that before. The check and balance system. All right, that's the essence of federalism. Different authorities at different levels that can, in one way or another, resist usurpations by authorities at other levels. And it's that resistance that maintains a deterrent effect. You go to the Department of the Interior, and the people in Washington know that whatever they do in terms of their regulations will only go so far in Nevada or Arizona, so forth and so on, because the local militia are aware of the constitutional limitations. Now the bureaucrats in Washington are deterred from even attempting to promulgate unconstitutional regulations because they know they'll be thrown back in their face as soon as they attempt to enforce them at the local level. Of course, we have none of that now.
No. One other thing, just a quick aside. I don't think Texas would have any problem at all gathering enough able-bodied men and women to form a legitimate constitutional militia to do exactly what you've been describing. I think there'd be so many volunteers they wouldn't know how to handle them. They want that state. They're very proud of their state, and they want that border secure. They're waiting for
the White House to do it.
That's not going to happen.
No. No, the governor would not have to threaten people with court-martial if they didn't come out. He'd have several million people lined up the day after he came up with the announcement.
That's the way I see it. And that would shake the executive branch down to its brain-dead feet.
And the important thing is, once that happened, once people realized at the state level what real constitutional authority they have, no matter what gives them, you know, the inkling of that. Okay, we've got an invasion.
Yeah.
That's the first example. But once they realize, wait a minute, we have this power in general. It's not just directed to invasions. It can also be directed towards the execution of the laws. And how big an area is that? Right? Now they'll begin to say, Governor Abbott, we want to take the next step. We want to go in this direction. We want to make this thing into essentially a permanent operation that deals with all of these levels of intra-federal interaction. And that's why they don't talk about it, Jeff. They don't talk about it because the political party system does not want the real political power in this country going back into the hands
of the people
themselves.
Never, the people. Never. No. What you said about Washington being aware of this party issue as a threat was very interesting. I've never heard that before.
Well, look at his farewell address.
Mm-hmm.
I have always considered his farewell address to be the single most important document of its kind in American history, because he really lays out what some of the long range dangers. I mean, they already had the Federalist Party and what was called at the time the Republican Party in Washington's day, mm-hmm. and so you had the Hamilton versus Jefferson, big money, Wall Street, central bank, Alexander Hamilton versus the agrarian People's Republican view of Jefferson. That was already there, mm-hmm. and Washington saw that as dangerous. He saw where that could go. Now what we have is the cultural Marxist versus, I don't know what the other alternative term you want to use, political parties problem in this country. It's gone beyond the point at which we're talking about the political parties in the sense of both of them having more or less an interest in maintaining a true Republican form of government. I think there's a real interest among these political parties in destroying the Republican form of government.
You got it.
They're certainly doing a good job of it, even if it's inadvertent.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
And the problem, once again, is what Franklin said to that woman when he came out of the Constitutional Convention and she asked him, what have you given us? What kind of a government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? And he said, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. All right? It's the if you can keep it part.
I remember that. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And this is the difficulty. The Constitution presents various mechanisms and institutions, one of them being the militia structure at both the national level and the state level, as means for maintaining, for keeping the free state. Second Amendment, well-regulated militia being necessary to secure the free state. Virginia Constitution. A well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state.
Proper,
you see exactly the same thinking there.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah. And that was written in 1776, the Second Amendment, 1791. Mm-hmm. So the Virginians were always a little bit ahead on this. All right? Mm-hmm. Madison, Jefferson, Patrick mm-hmm. Henry, you run down that list of Washington, you run down that list of eminent Virginians. Right? But that was the basic principle. If you want to maintain a free state and a Republican form of government, which is made up of this complex of free states in the federal system, you have to have, at every level in the federal structure, a well-regulated militia actually functioning. So there are supposed to be now 50 of them. They started out with 13. There are supposed to be 50 of them in each of the states actually functioning, which they don't do in any of the states I know of, including Virginia. I read the Virginia Code. Oh, it's very good in many respects. Does it actually function? No. Every lawyer I have ever talked to in Virginia, when I ask him if he's a member of the militia, he looks at me as if he's crazy, and then I explain to him the statute, and he's never heard of it before.
How can that be? How can no one read the Constitution and digest it? How can no one do that? It's rudimentary homework if you're going to be engaged in politics.
Well, you didn't go to Harvard Law School.
No, I didn't.
I did. And the constitutional law class that I took at Harvard Law School, I would have mm-hmm. expected that what we would do in the first couple of sessions
sure.
would be to read the Constitution.
Read the document.
And have a little discussion about, well, here's the structure. Let's not get into the details, but at least here's the structure of this thing.
Sure.
Is that what we did? No. We started right away reading snippets out of the opinions of the Supreme Court, as if the Supreme Court was somehow the Constitution.
Wow. Wow.
And that was Harvard Law School. I imagine it's worse now.
I imagine it's lots worse now. That's pretty bad. Right.
That was 73. So we're talking
a long time ago. Did you ever get to the point of actually reading the Constitution?
Well, I did, but you mean
class?
As an assignment?
Part of the curriculum.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. No.
Oh, jeez. Edwin.
We start out right away reading what somebody else was telling us about the Constitution, these various Supreme Court opinions.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay.
These communists are clever.
Well, as soon as you get away from the actual document and you get to judicial opinions.
Hey, you never got
to
the document.
You can say anything you want.
Yes.
Now, you talk about the Second Amendment. Here's an example of the problem.
Yeah.
We have a lot of people in this country, Second Amendment proponents, and their hearts are in the right place. Their heads are a little muddled, but their hearts are in the right place. And they have a concept called the individual right to keep and bear arms.
Mm-hmm.
And this works itself out in terms of your ability to defend yourself against a criminal, either in your home or maybe on the street. Okay.
Yeah.
And I say, well, that's fine. If you had a militia structure, people would certainly have an individual right to keep and bear arms. You have an individual duty to do so.
It's an obligation.
Right.
Yes.
Out of the duty comes the right. Now, you have this obligation to have arms and to be trained in order to provide for the free state, because you have an obligation
to
state. And then when you have those arms in your hands and you're trained, of course you can use them to defend yourself. Who would question that? Right? Plus, if you look at the first duty of the militia, execute the laws of the Union, self-defense is the immediate execution of the law by the person who is attacked. There's no policeman there. There's no court there. There's no third party, a public official of any kind. You're there. A criminal is attacking you. He's violating the law. You are now the executor of the law. Well, that's the militia function. That's the individual militia function that's performed every time someone defends himself against a criminal. But here we have these individual right people, and they, in the District of Columbia versus Heller case, in which Mr. Heller wanted to have a gun in his home in the District of Columbia, and the various regulations they had made that essentially impossible, handgun.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to the Supreme Court of the United States, and Justice Scalia writes the opinion and says, oh, the Second Amendment protects the right of a person to have a handgun in his home. What happened? Well, the District of Columbia played games, changing their regulations and so forth and so on. And last thing I heard about Heller very recently was he's still fighting them over what kind of ammunition he can have. His problem hasn't been solved by that decision.
No.
The other day, the Supreme Court came out with an opinion, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, dealing with the very draconian, essentially impossible laws that the state of New York has for people to be able to carry a concealed firearm outside of their homes. Supreme Court struck this thing down, opinion by Justice Thomas, good opinion as far as it goes. What happened? Within 3 days, the governor of New York, Ms. Hochul, and her legislature had enacted a new concealed carry permit law, which was more draconian than the one that the Supreme Court just declared unconstitutional. The new one requires you to turn over 3 years of your internet, Facebooks, over all the social media postings, so they can determine what your thoughts might have been.
I know.
And now we've got a thought police mechanism that's built into this. Well, what was interesting was to see these proponents of the individual right fuming about what happened in New York. They said, we just won the Supreme Court case, and now we're going to go back into litigation again and again and again to fight what New York, and probably Massachusetts and New Jersey and California, you can name the other states, will do to get around the Supreme Court opinion. Well, now if you had the militia structure, you wouldn't be worried about this problem. Everyone would have a duty to carry a firearm.
It's already called for. It's mandated.
It's already
you
there.
You have to be armed.
Yeah.
That's right.
So this is what I find it fascinating, because I've been doing this, talking about the militia since, on the internet, since 2005.
Yeah.
That's a long time, right? 17 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm talking to the wind.
Well, you were on a long time ago.
I find none of these people, on the individual right Second Amendment bandwagon wants to talk about the militia. Meanwhile, we have in Congress the resurrection of the Clinton assault weapons ban. Right? All of these AR-15, AK-47, semi-automatic rifles.
Anything semi-automatic is an assault weapon to these people.
Call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
Call it a weapon of war. Call it an assault fire. What is the third requirement for the militia? Repel invasions. Is the Chinese Women's Army going to invade Pennsylvania or Virginia or even New York with slingshots? Or are they going to invade with weapons of war in their hands? The very fact that you are in a militia requires you to have the kind of weapon that you could use to repel an invasion by foreign forces. Well, what are those firearms? Well, they're the AR-15 type firearms. Probably not even semi-automatic, maybe automatic. Right? But they're certainly at least the ones that are trying to be banned by Congress. So here we have Congress, which has the explicit constitutional power to call forth a militia, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, disarming the American people so that they cannot, even by themselves, repel invasions. How do you characterize that kind of behavior?
It's Bolshevik overthrow.
Well, okay, that's good enough.
They just will not yield to the Constitution. I wish that segment were printed out and put in a little booklet, a little two-page booklet, and given to every American who cares about being armed and understands that it's their obligation under the Constitution to be armed and make that case to anyone who gets in their way. That's not talked about, Edwin. You know that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Why? Because, and here I have to quote Mao Zedong, although he isn't the only one that said it, but he's very famous. Political power grows out of the barrel of the gun.
Always.
That is the truth of the matter. Yeah. That segment of the society that holds the balance of force, whether it's swords in Rome or guns today, has political power. It is the ultimate political power within that society. It could be the Praetorian Guard. It could be the People's Liberation Army in China, right? It could be the SS in Germany, whatever you want to pick as an example, right? In our society, it is supposed to be whom? Who is supposed to have the sovereignty in this country? The people themselves, right?
Yeah.
And if the people themselves are supposed to have the sovereignty, the ultimate political power, then it's the people themselves who are supposed to hold the ultimate power through the mechanisms of force. And that's the whole concept of the militia, because if you arm the vast majority of people in Virginia, as I said, I calculated this was about 4,500,000 to 600,000 were eligible. Right? If you arm the vast majority of the population and put into their heads the realization that they are being armed not to go out to do target shooting, but to defend their country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you will then have the people in control. You will have the popular sovereignty. You won't have a place for political party structures that are antithetical to the concepts of republican government.
All controlled by fascist-oriented multinationals. It's all money.
That's right. None of that would exist.
No.
And that's, of course, why the people who are in control constantly, as the expression goes, bad-mouthing anything that has to do with militia. They made militia into a dirty word. It's actually a four-letter word. Without realizing it's right there in the Constitution. It's in the body of the Constitution, the original Constitution. It's in the Second Amendment, and it is probably, word for word, in every state constitution, or certainly state statutory code, in all the 50 states.
I'll bet it is. So how do we extricate ourselves from this horrible mess of failing to stand on our Constitution? We did it. We didn't stand on the Constitution. We didn't force them to honor the greatest document ever conceived.
Well, I think these problems arise in certain conflict situations today, right? Because people aren't thinking conceptually. They're not thinking in terms of political theories.
Uh-huh.
They're thinking in terms of policy conflicts all the time. So if you go to something like what's going on in public education in various states, where they're fighting the critical race theory and some of these other abominations that have been put into the curricula of the elementary schools. And you look at that and you say, what is the structural problem there? The structural problem is teacher unions, public sector collective bargaining for teacher unions. That has to be eliminated. Well, that can be eliminated tomorrow because that comes directly from, say, some state statute. There's no constitutional right for public sector collective bargaining by teacher unions. There's some statute that gives them a statutory authority to do that. Eliminate that statute and they're gone. So you solve that problem by elimination of certain elements that have been encrusted on our political and legal system through these factional interests, anti-Republican interests. But the militia is at the opposite end of this argument, because the militia is already there. It's a constitutional entity. It's supposed to be, or they are supposed to be, implemented. And that simply has to be demanded by people at the state level. Now, you're not going to get Congress to do that directly. Even if you had a Republican turnover, you're not going to get Congress to do that directly now. There's a lot of education has to be done. And there are states in which it can be done. I think it can be done, or at least the beginning of it could be done in Virginia, probably in Florida, maybe in those states that have this immediate invasion problem where they have to look at, well, what can we actually do in our system to put enough, quote-unquote, boots on the ground to begin to deal with the immediate problem at the border. I'd say, if I was sitting down with Abbott, I'd say, here it is, right here. Tell me how many people you have. Look at the latest demographic study of the ages. Let's go, not 16, maybe that's too young. Let's go 18. Let's go 18 to 45. How many 18 to 45 males do you have? Forget the weak females. We'll just take the males. How many of those do you have? Oh, 2 million people? Good, there you go. There it is. There's your solution. You have a force of 2 million ready to go under your statute. Now let's find out how you're going to organize them, give them some training and so forth, and get them out there. All right.
I don't think there'd be any shortage of volunteers at all.
I think it's going to have to be done by the governors, because if you think of trying to do this through the legislatures, you run into all of the roadblocks and the difficulties of legislative procedure. There's always someone in some committee that can table a particular bill, whatever, the games they play. But under the militia statutes that I've seen, the governors as commanders-in-chief have a great deal of authority of their own. They just have to exercise it. And the courts can't intervene in this. That's another fascinating thing. You know, you think about it, well, the courts are going to get involved. We'll be litigating forever, as they are doing for the individual right to keep and bear arms. They're litigating forever, and they're never solving the problem, because no sooner do they win a Supreme Court decision than you have the New York legislature or California, whatever, they pass a new piece of aggressive anti-Second Amendment legislation, and you have to go back through the 3, 4, 5 years of litigation to have that corrected if it ever reaches the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, Gilligan versus Morgan is the case. It dealt with the Kent State situation in which some of the National Guard people fired and some students were killed and wounded. Mm-hmm. And some of those people, or the ones who represented the student groups, they brought a case asking the courts to intervene and to essentially control the National Guard, the militia.
All right.
Goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, this is not a justiciable question. This is not a question that can be brought before the courts. The authority for dealing with the militia is entirely in the hands of the governor or the legislature, which, of course, can enact statutes. The governor is in control of this. The courts cannot intervene. When they say not a justiciable question, it means you can't bring the case. It doesn't mean you bring the case and you lose it. You bring the case and it's dismissed. The court's supposed to say, we can't hear this. So the Supreme Court's already ruled on this. If a governor wants to take action dealing with the use of his militia for this, let's say, the invasion situation, the courts can't intervene. Congress can't intervene because it's done, the use of the militia is done entirely within the jurisdiction of the particular state under state law, and Congress has the power to deal with the militia only with respect to laws of the union. Okay. Number three, in terms of the practicalities of it, well, it's just numbers. How many people can you bring into the field? You're talking about several million at a minimum.
Millions.
All right. Millions. Okay, several million at a minimum. All right.
Agreed. Yeah.
So it's practical from that point of view. It's insulated against congressional or judicial interference. Even the President of the United States cannot interfere because he is the commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states only when called into the service of the United States, not when the militia are in the service of their own states. So that level of government, the Washington, D.C. level, is completely excluded from this. And we have the reserve power in this particular instance of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, that says that the states, even without the consent of Congress, can engage in war to repel an invasion. I don't know what more you would need.
No, you don't need any. No, you don't.
Now, if you and I were writing the Constitution from scratch, would we need to put in any more?
No. That would be it. Edwin, we've got to run. We're over. But that was an incredibly important hour, brilliantly and articulated as well as it could be done. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Right.
Bye-bye. Yes, we'll talk again. Okay, good night. Dr. Edwin Vieira. Okay, back with hour number two. And lots to think about there. It's all there. All we need is a governor with a backbone. All right, we'll be right back.